Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Good morning and welcome back to the Roundtable. Verlin Klinkenborg's regular column, The Rural Life, is one of the most read and beloved in the New York Times since 1997. He has written eloquently on every aspect, large and small, of life on his upstate New York farm, including his animals, the weather and landscape, and the trials and rewards of physical labor, as well as the broader issues about agriculture and land use behind farming today. His new book, More Scenes from the Rural Life, gathers together 150 of his best pieces since his last collection, The Rural Life, was published a decade ago. It's a great pleasure to welcome Verlin Klinkenborg back to the Roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
I love this book.
Thank you.
I love the last one. I love reading the column. What got you writing in the first place about this place and thinking that it could be something?
Well, I had been writing a lot about nature sort of wherever I happened to be in the country, in the West, in Wyoming, Montana, California. And my editor at the editorial page, Howell Raines, in the spring of 1998, basically said, why don't you think about writing about the country from your farm, and we'll call it The Rural Life. And he designed that little logo, that silo and tractor that sets it off from the rest of the editorial page. And really, I actually had never thought about doing that as a regular thing, but the opportunity was there, and it turned out to be a really good fit for the paper and for me.
What is your deadline in the sense of what do you do them when you want to do them?
I do them when I want to do them. I basically want to make sure the readers are ready for the next one. I want to make sure they're eager and not giving them too many at once. Let's put
it
that way.
So is that another way of I like how you portrayed that. But mm-hmm. is there mm-hmm. is that also another way of saying, you know, if it also depends on what strikes you. I mean, in the sense of that yes, there'll be an issue today, but maybe it'll be a couple weeks before I come up with another issue.
Well, for me, I have a kind of internal clock that basically says after 3 weeks, it's time to start thinking about another one.
Okay.
They don't appear regularly, but there's always a spot for them. And I think the issue really is the balance of the page over a period of weeks. How many rural lives make sense on the editorial page? And the answer is usually not much more than one a month.
Mm. For you, what has the were you ready for The Rural Life?
No. I mean, I'd been prepared for it in all sorts of ways. My dad and the rest of my family had built a place for him in the foothills of California, which was a small farm kind of like mine. And he had grown up as a farm kid, and I'd spent a lot of time on farms as a boy. But what that did was teach me how much I didn't know. So when I came to this small farm in 97, it was a matter of educating myself as quickly as I could. And the best way to educate yourself with animals is to get some, because then suddenly it's no longer academic. You've got to figure out, how do I raise chickens? How do I take care of pigs? What do I do with horses? And you learn very quickly.
So does that make you, as a journalist, a better observer of sort of being the outside looking in as mm-hmm. to this life?
Well, I think that I think of myself as being on the inside of this life by now, after 16 years of doing it.
Oh, sure, by now.
Yeah.
Yes.
But I think that there was a kind of freshness of perspective in the sense that, well, the best example is my cousins and uncles who had been raising pigs most of their lives. They found it hilarious that I was about to go out and get two pigs. And for them, looking at me, it was like watching this New York novice start all over from scratch. And I had to relearn all these things that they'd learned when they were 8 years old. So in a sense, it did make me a better observer. But what really makes me a better observer and I've been surprised by this, is actually the presence of the animals themselves, because they are noticing an entirely different set of things than humans notice. And whenever I walk out onto my place, whether it's the chickens or the horses or whatever is there, they're alert to things that I'm never alert to, and vice versa.
And that comes from, that observation comes from watching them.
Just watching them, yeah. The best example is I had a couple of heritage turkeys a few years ago, probably a decade ago, and I would walk out into the chicken yard, and they would be making this sort of gurgling electronic noise of alarm. And I looked around and around and around, couldn't figure out what it was until I finally saw at the very limit of my visible range a red-tailed hawk way up in the sky. Just, I mean, really a pinpoint to me. But to them, it was this very present thing. And after that, that was one of the cardinal moments for me where my own idea about perception changed. That's one of the moments when I realized I may go out and think that I'm paying attention and that I'm being especially perceptive, but really my perceptions are overlaid by the perceptions of all these other creatures. And to pay attention to what they're perceiving is really a fascinating task.
And then to take that a step further, to write about it so that an audience, mm-hmm. and in the case of where you are placed within the paper, a general audience, mm-hmm. will not only understand but care about mm-hmm. the perceptions of those animals through your eyes.
Yeah. Well, I think there is an analogy that works at the heart of this, which is that my perceptions are echoed by the perceptions of my readers. What I find when I read and talk, people come up to me and they say, you know, I noticed exactly that same thing, but I didn't have the words to put it in. In other words, the rural lives work because they address a perceptive quality in the reader himself or herself, and they pay attention to it. It evokes a kind of outpouring of attention.
The last time you were with us was to talk about your book, Several Short Sentences About Writing, which is it's a small book, mm-hmm. that I love. And you talk in there about writing and basically laying out your philosophy. But we see this. What you wrote about in that book is what we see in this column, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's your language, which I have seen described as exotic, even the vocabulary, is you're not only watching those animals and thinking and observing, but then there's also the labor of the writing and how to properly mm-hmm. describe that.
Well, I think any writer is always trapped between two layers. One is the layer of reality, and the other is the layer of language. And we live in between those two things. And if you think of language not as a collection of words or a collection of rules, but as an index of human perceptions over the eons, it's just another way of saying that we've got these tools to perceive, these tools to express perception, and my job as a writer is essentially doing nothing more than trying to find the language that gives me the clearest possible take on what I've noticed.
So the thinking about it and playing with the language, does that come easier to you, or is it still always a puzzle?
Oh, it's a puzzle, but it's a pleasurable puzzle
right now.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been yelled at too many times by writers when I use the word fun, but
no,
because there's nothing fun about writing, but there is a pleasure that comes.
Absolutely, because writing is really problem solving. You have every sentence raises a set of problems, every paragraph, every chapter, and solving those problems in ways that are elegant and historically accurate and interesting. How can that not be pleasurable? But in the course of my own life as a writer, it's gotten much easier, of course, but that's just a matter of practice. It's something I always say to my students. The only difference between me and you is just 30 years of experience. Mm. That's all.
So what are you looking for? As you mentioned, the timing, what are you looking for in a column? I mean, are you aware of, okay, I've written too much about animals. Mm-hmm. I'm going to look about the weather. I'm going to look at other issues.
I'm always sort of hyper aware of what I've written, because the goal is not to repeat myself, but also not to not to in any way become sentimental or romantic about it, but to keep it at the level of clear and fairly dry observation, in the sense that it isn't emotive. What triggers a piece for me is usually just something I've noticed on the land. It could be minute, something as simple as thistledown blowing in October, for example. That's the kind of thing that gets stuck away in my head, and it just kind of accumulates over a day or two as I play with it. But often what I do in writing a piece is accept the fact that I need to write a piece that's now time, and I feel like I'm ready to do it. I have no idea what I'm going to write about. And to sit down with that kind of vacancy in my own head and try to figure out, okay, what's going to come out of this? Where do I start? What's the next? And that's how it always works for me, that sense that writing is about discovering what I don't know yet, discovering what I don't know how to say yet.
And what I find, you talked about the readers a moment ago, and the fact that this plays so well in the New York Times says a lot about their audience, about New Yorkers in general, and about this, because I guess I'm overgeneralizing, but kind of two camps, one of the New Yorker who wish that they could do this, and then the person who's actually done this wants to see how you're handling it.
Yeah. Well, the first group is by far the majority.
Absolutely.
And what I've discovered is that everybody I met either has a connection to the land. This is basically anybody who's sort of 45 or older has a connection to the land through family, through their own experience. Younger people, not so much. But there's a lot of fantasy about it. And what I find is that when I meet readers, it's always really interesting to me because they live in their own heads in a farm that's much more interesting than mine. It's much better kept. It's full of much more interesting creatures and inhabited by a much more interesting human. But I think that's just the way it goes. I discover all the time that people project upon this column whatever it is they want to project upon it, whether it's the zeal about living more organically, whether it's a desire to live more pastorally, whatever it is, if it's just a desire to escape the city. And what I found is that some of the most ardent readers I have are people who really have never been to the country at all. They live in Manhattan or they live in Brooklyn and they think about the country, but they'd rather think about it in imagination than actually live there.
Does that put pressure on you to sort of adequately describe the experience?
No, it's funny.
The real life?
It's funny because the goal is really to use the real language. So, for example, in a recent piece, I can't remember. I talk about a Pulaski, which is a firefighting tool that has a pick at one end and a kind of spade-like contraption on the other end. The fun is using the actual language. And my goal is always, if I use a word or a name that a reader doesn't know, if it's possible to give an indication of what it is quickly, that's fine. But I never think of it as really that bothersome for a reader to have to look something up. It's a chance to add to your own storehouse of language. So for me, that you mentioned earlier that my vocabulary sometimes seems exotic to some people. Well, one of the things I try to say to my students is that your job as a writer is to be a curator of the language, to know as much of it as you can, to be as aware of it historically as you can, and to use it in ways that are as rich as possible. And if that means a reader turning from the editorial page to the dictionary, that's not a terrible thing.
More Scenes from the Rural Life is the new book by Verlin Klinkenborg. It is published by Princeton Architectural Press, which it's a beautiful, beautiful production. You're going to be at North Shore Bookstore on Friday night
at
7 o'clock, and then you're going to be in Brooklyn?
On the 31st of July at Book Court.
A Book Court in Brooklyn. Great store. Absolutely. You can find out more about those. It's Verlin Klinkenborg's More Scenes from the Rural Life, published by Princeton. Always a pleasure to have you here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.